From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1901 in Germany. A psychiatrist named Alois identified the first case of a disease that could come to bear his name, and you know by now his last name, Alzheimer. The psychiatrist had followed a woman's case from 1901 to her death in 1906 and then reported publicly on it. Over the next 5 years, another 11 cases were reported, and that was, of course, just the beginning. Today, Alzheimer's touches so many families around the world and is one of the fastest-growing diseases, the sixth leading cause of death in this country. Every 67 seconds, a new case in this country. This hour, we're looking at the impact on caregivers and a new respite program designed to help. We're also going to talk about the very latest in research, and we have a full studio. This is the kind of hour where we expect that, we're going to hear from our audience. In fact, we're already hearing from our listeners online via email, sharing their stories. Whether you're a caregiver or someone in your family has gone through it, you can join the conversation. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. In studio is the director of UR Medicine's AdCare. That's the Alzheimer's Disease Care, Research, and Education Program. It's Dr. Anton Thorstensen. It's nice to have you here, Dr. Anton.
Thank you.
Also here is Anne-Marie Cook, the president and CEO of Lifespan of Greater Rochester. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Teresa Galbier is here. She's the president and CEO of the Alzheimer's Association of Rochester and the Finger Lakes region. Teresa, nice to have you.
Thank you, Evan.
Jason Doucette's here. He is a caregiver and is going to be talking about it from the caregiver perspective. And Jason, nice to have you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
Can I mention your background as well?
Go ahead.
All right. Well, Jason and I worked together at Channel 13, and he's one of the big-hearted people I know, and he's still in the news producing world, even though we are now in different newsrooms. So it's nice to have you here, and we'll be talking to Jason about his experience. And Sharon Seitz is here as well. Sharon is a respite worker, and Sharon, nice to have you as well. So a lot to talk about, and Anne-Marie Cook, when it comes to caregiving, that's where a lot of the focus is now, the Caregiver Respite Project, and I want to talk about what it is. What's going on?
Yeah, we're lucky. We have a collaborative program going on in the community with Lifespan, the Alzheimer's Association, Community Place of Greater Rochester, and the Ad Council, really getting the word out that caregivers, family caregivers, need help and they need respite options. So we've put together a program in which family caregivers can get respite all the way from a couple of hours from a volunteer all the way to paid respite options by calling one number and really helping out caregivers in that respect. Because we know that 80% of long-term care is provided by family caregivers, and we know caregivers need help.
All right, what's the number?
It's number is 325-2800, or go online, helpacaregiver.org.
All right. When it comes to caregiving, I want to start with Jason. Jason Doucette is here, someone who is caregiving now, and I want you to kind of work us through your story and what you've experienced. So, Jason, tell us a little bit about your family's story.
Well, I was actually out of town about 12 years ago.
Okay.
So I had moved out of town. I was working at different TV stations, and my mother at 52 was showing some symptoms. It's odd for it to happen that soon.
So 52 years old, she was forgetful about things? Was that?
It was just forgetfulness, absent-mindedness, stuff that was not her. I mean, like this time of year, she made 2,500 cookies. Today, she would be delivering those to the doctor and to the dentist and running all over town. The mom that was doing everything for you. I got a care package every month I was away, not just at college, like an adult. I would get a box of cookies sent to the TV station.
Because you're always her child, you know? That's all right.
And
then she stopped or started to forget some of that?
It was just we were noticing changes where it was like absent-mindedness, showing up early, showing up late to things, something's not right. Mom's just not there. She baked and cooked all the time, and the recipes were, off, and things were happening.
Oh. But what did you think it was?
Well, we didn't know. There was, Alzheimer's was the last thing on my mind. I went to the doctor, and initially went for a screening for depression, and the doctor who my mom saw said it was depression and gave her Prozac, and she got worse. And, when we realized, dad kind of sat there and said, we need to try something different here. and it had kind of regressed at that point. She was 54. They tested for brain tumor to see if there was something there. I did, you know, MRI and all the tests, and couldn't find anything. Eventually went to the memory center, and the doctor diagnosed her with Alzheimer's after extensive screening.
So it had been about 2 years from your first concerns about memory loss to the actual diagnosis. By the end of that two-year process, at that point, had Alzheimer's entered the picture in terms of a family discussion about a possibility?
Well, it was, you know, I was sitting there. It was, you know, and it's horrible because, you know, you're kind of cheering for the brain tumor because, you know, you can treat the brain tumor. You can take out a tumor. You can't take out Alzheimer's.
What a remarkable statement. And instantly, Anne-Marie Cook was nodding because I think you were nodding because you've probably heard people say things like that before.
I've heard so many people say the exact same thing
statement.
That I'd rather have cancer than my family member have Alzheimer's.
Yeah, an amazing statement. And Teresa, I think it's also important to point out here that, you know, Jason and his family, when his mom was 52, they're not thinking Alzheimer's because most of us probably aren't to begin with. But second of all, we've talked on this program about people who get diagnosis of Alzheimer's younger than normal, and that's important to talk about. But it's still uncommon at 52, right?
It is. It's still a rare disease for those under the age of 65. About 200,000 Americans have Alzheimer's disease younger than that age.
Okay. Yeah. But how many Americans have Alzheimer's disease?
More than 5 million Americans.
Okay. So the vast majority.
That's correct. But I think what Jason and his family did was just so thoughtful. And the right thing is that they kept going until they got the answers. Because oftentimes families won't. And they wouldn't even have the word Alzheimer's in their vocabulary at that age. But it's important that they continue to go to see their medical professionals so that they can at least rule out a certain number of things and then take a look at what other possibilities there are. And then eventually when you do actually get the diagnosis, then you can start the thoughtful planning at that point.
Sure. And so as someone who shifts into the mode of a son with a parent at 54 with Alzheimer's, and your family has to make decisions, Jason, what were those conversations like? How did you decide how to approach it?
It was, you know, it was difficult. You know, I knew moving away upset mom, and at that point I knew mom was on the clock and I didn't know how many good years she had. So I just kind of was going home the next week and went to interviews, and I'm like, I've got to move back home. And you know, family was supportive, saying, you know, Jay, you know, you've advanced your career, you know, you don't have to do this. Like, I you know, it wasn't an option for me. I was going to do it, and no regrets at all. You know, I've you know, got the time to spend with mom, you know, and it's to a point right now where, you know, she's so different. It's not really even her in a lot of ways. It's, you know, it's a woman who looks like my mother, but is just, you know, I would love for her to say, you know, Jay, I'm proud of you. Jay, I love you. But it's stuff where those coherent thoughts aren't possible anymore.
Yeah. Was there, I assume over 10 years that's been sort of a gradual, but was there a day or a moment where you actually felt like it just doesn't feel like her anymore?
You know, it was, you know, early on, like 50, like, I guess that's just, when I say she was like 50 or 55 or 56, and I'm sitting there and she was helping me in the kitchen, and I was, you know, cooking, and, you know, hot temperatures, oil, and all of a sudden I turned my back and there's a fire. And I mean, it wasn't a big fire. It was something where, you know, I had to get the fire extinguisher, but it was like, mom, you can't be in the kitchen with me right now. And, you know, it's the progression has kind of slowly happened, and we're to a point, like the past 6-8 months, it's just been very, very much downhill and a lot more challenging.
So now, as someone who's gone through the caregiving process for a number of years, Jason, you know, you're here on this program because, you know, you represent a growing community. You know, there are a lot of people listening right now who are either caregivers or will be caregivers. What has been the hardest part?
I think the hardest part has just been, you know, just, you know, knowing what would happen with the person who you're talking to, and just this is how she would have reacted and this is how she's reacting now. That kind of thing. Just, you know, the lack of emotion and stuff to deal with. And it's, you know, the constant need to keep an eye on them, is it's a challenge. And it's something where, you know, I'm My father is retired, and he stays with Mom, but, you know, there are challenges, and, you know, I want to give him a break because, you know, I'll sit there, and I take Mom to Wegmans with me, and, you know, it's to give him a break for a couple hours, and it is very challenging, and it's forced me to be a more patient person. But, you know, we're helping out Dad. I'm sure. Working, you know, 50, 60 hours a week at Channel 10 right now, and my sister helps when she can. She's married. She has 3 children, all under 7. So we're doing what we can, but it takes a village, and the programs that the Alzheimer's Association and Lifespan offer, it's vital.
Well, I will say, clearly, your mother's been fortunate to have you. You know, that is really, really tough. And it's got to be mentally exhausting and physically. Is it more mentally or more physically exhausting? Is it both?
It's mentally for me. Yeah. It's just, you know, it's especially, you know, around the holidays and stuff like that. You know, and it takes a toll on my father. I mean, I think I've seen him show more emotion, you know, Not to say he's not a caring guy, but, you know, he wouldn't show the emotion I've seen him show in the past few years, especially since things progressed.
All right. Well, then let's talk a little bit more about what's going to be available now. And let me just ask Teresa then, what do you want people in our community to know now about respite and about help for caregivers? What's the message?
Well, and I think Jason set this up perfectly. You know, you talk about the physical caregiving that it takes to take care of somebody with Alzheimer's, but there's a grieving going on and a sense of loss and the emotional impact, and it will often cause families to become very socially isolated, and then depression sets in. And so we really do worry about the caregivers. 80% of people with dementia are taken care of somehow by a loved one, a family caregiver. And so it's important that we be able to offer supports to the family caregiver so that that person can continue to age in place for as long as it's possible. And so our community has come together with Lifespan and with the Ad Council and with the Rochester Area Community Foundation, and we said, you know, we can't offer respite to every single person all the time with the limited resources that we have, but we can offer some natural supports. And this is really a natural support. It's a support that we've developed for people in the early stages of the disease. And what they need most often is just someone to be with them, to have an intimate conversation, to be someone who can be safe with them so that the person who's the caregiver realizes that perhaps they're in good hands for that moment in time and that they can go and do something else and have a little bit of a relief from the stress of day-to-day care.
And I'd like to define what respite really means here and what a respite worker does. So, Sharon, can we swing one of the microphones over to you? Again, this is such a packed studio today, and we're sharing microphones, so pull that nice and close to you there. And tell me about your work as a respite worker, what it is that you do.
What I do is actually relieve the primary caregiver. I go into the home or a mutually arranged location and actually be with the person that has been affected by Alzheimer's. We plan activities, we do outings, we do things that have meaning to that individual that may be overlooked or not able to complete from the caregiver.
And how many people are you working with? Give me a sense for the scope of it.
I'm currently working with 2 families.
You're working with 2 families.
Yes.
How many of you are there, the respite workers? It sounds like we need more.
There is a huge need,
yeah.
Yes. I would take on more if my time allowed, definitely.
What is, for you, what are you witnessing with families and with caregivers, the impact? I mean, I'm reading, you sent over these fact sheets, you know, that being a caregiver for someone with Alzheimer's can take 10 years off your life. And that's a very stark number. And that's going to be a lot of us facing that challenge if we are not getting some kind of help. What kind of impact are you seeing providing the respite?
I think the biggest impact is for the caregiver and just making sure that they do feel comfortable in leaving with me being there. And as far as the individual affected, it gives them a change. They can do other things that they may not be able to do. I give them as much leeway as possible to make decisions and just support those decisions and reassuring that everything really is okay.
Okay. Well, Alex just wants to know what qualifications you need to become a volunteer to do respite work.
Training. 8 hours of training.
But you don't have to have already have that. You can get that training.
You can get
that
training.
So anybody who's
training.
Listening right now who thinks that's tough, but it's needed, and I'm willing to do it, you don't have to have pre-qualifications on this.
That is correct.
Okay. What's the training like?
The training, it goes into the disease process itself, signs and symptoms to look for while you're actually providing respite care so that that can be reported if need be, safety precautions, what can be done, what cannot be done while you're out in the community, and just anything that involves an individual's daily living.
We have a number of questions coming in as well on these issues, but I just want to make sure that we hit this point one more time here. So the call's out for volunteers. You could take it. I mean, what's the number? What's the real goal here? You need how many? You want how many? Sharon, Anne-Marie, yeah, go ahead.
Evan, right now I know there's 30 families that really wanted a volunteer respite this month and we couldn't provide it, but I'm going to tell you it's hundreds of people of volunteers we need.
Honestly, I saw that release and it said, you know, you need 30 right now, but I thought 30, you know, it's got to be higher than 30.
It's hundreds, actually. Yeah. It's just 30 this week that would have loved to have been matched with a volunteer that we could not provide a volunteer this month.
Okay, before I get to some of the questions and comments from email and talk a little bit on the research side with Dr. Anton, just Jason Doucette, as a caregiver then, you know, as you kind of continue to move through this process, as you said, especially the last 6 to 8 months have been harder. What do you think the impact can be on your family, just to kind of get that kind of respite help?
Oh, I mean, it's been huge. We sat there, I mean, just this week, my nephew had a concert for school, and dad had tapped into the 40 hours of respite care that the Alzheimer's Association had. It's just huge, and I think dad hadn't tapped into it till recently when mom had gotten progressively worse. And, you know, kind of turned out for more resources that were in the community just because out of need. I think if people knew these resources were there, they would tap into them. And they're trying to say, you know, I can handle it, I can handle it, I can handle it. Well, you can't handle it. And there's help out there. That 30 number is, you know, that's got easily 300.
Okay. Right. Or more here. I mean, we're talking about the sixth leading killer of Americans. I mean, new cases every single day. I do think to some degree people who are thinking about volunteering are would feel that this is daunting, that this is really intimidating. And Anne-Marie, you know, what would you say to people who have it in their heart to help, but they think, boy, this has got to be so difficult working in this kind of a way?
We always want to tell volunteers we provide support. Alzheimer's Association and Lifespan. And as Sharon said, as part of the training is not only learning about the disease and safety measures, but also where to call and how you get that support. So you're not alone out there. So if anything happens, we're just one phone call away and we can support you and help you. But we have a lot of assessments that go on ahead of time to make sure the match is appropriate and that the volunteer feels comfortable.
Okay. And Dr. Anton?
And let me make one point here as well. And that is that people with Alzheimer's disease, we none of us wishes this for ourselves or for our loved ones. But let's understand that it's not all misery. There are people with Alzheimer's disease where, you know, again, not what you wish for, but they have a quality of life. They have a sense of humor. They enjoy things. They love being around people. They love doing activities, and they love connecting with what they used to do. And sometimes it takes someone from the outside to bring that in, because the primary caregiver is usually the elderly spouse, and then children that are already strained with their own work and life responsibilities. So somebody comes in and gives a new perspective or a new experience that can be incredibly enriching for both the patient, the caregiver who gets a break, as well as the volunteer. So I don't want to make it sound as if it is all misery.
I think that point's an important one. And Jason Doucette, watching your mother, I know it's tougher lately, and this has been a 12-year process. But even in the early years, you know, as things started to change, memory started to change, recognition started to change, did you find a sense of humor, even if it was shifting? I mean, did you find some joy at times?
Oh, yeah, I mean, there are times, you know, where she'll sit there and, you know, like, just, like, moments of clarity where she'll come out and say something, and or just like sit there and, you know, things have been rough, and then, you know, she responds well to music. So
I hear that so often.
So like that, the you know, you switch on the TV stations that have the music on, and every once in a while I start dancing, and I was like, okay, mom. You know, and it's just
was
like,
it the same music that made her dance that used to? I mean, I hear that sometimes that taps into something maybe deeper in the brain that, you know.
Yeah, it was something like, you know, one of her favorite albums was Tapestry from Carole King. So, you know, I don't know what happened to the record, but I was looking for something for Christmas and bought her a little CD player and got her a copy of Tapestry, and something, you know, she seems to like dance along, and sometimes every once in a while sing along, which is weird because, you know, it's been very difficult for her to speak lately and vocalize her feelings. It's coming out as gibberish at times, but like every once in a while it's like, you know, nails that lyric. And I'm like, okay, nice, mom.
Yeah. Because there are still parts of her there. That's just amazing. Yeah. Am I correct? I'll ask the panel. I mean, Teresa, I don't know. And when it comes to Alzheimer's, Dr. Anton, I think I've seen stories about the impact of music on the
Yeah, thing. And that's very true. Music and also, you know, musical skills. If you're a musician or you used to sing, that seems to be stored in a different part of the brain. And the part of the brain that doesn't seem to be quite as vulnerable to the damage, the kind of neuronal damage that we see in Alzheimer's disease. So you may lose your language and you may have a hard time expressing yourself, but you might be able to sing a tune and certainly enjoy music. And I've heard this repeatedly. So I remember very well one of my patients who was advanced in his disease and started going to a day socialization program. And it truly surprised the family that this was a powerful businessman who didn't seem to be very connected to music or have time for it. But there, you know, late in life, in mid-stage Alzheimer's disease, he just connected to music, and it was like a new chapter. His daughter, very musical, and she said, me and Dad, we found a new connection.
That is remarkable. Let me just read part of an email that came in from a listener named Tim, who writes, Evan, my mother was diagnosed earlier this year, and it has to be the hardest thing I've ever dealt with. I was in complete denial. I thought the changes I was seeing were just part of her hearing problem, and that's why she wasn't understanding some things. And there's been nothing worse than watching someone decline this way. So you might consider asking your guests about a couple of things. Would advanced planning have helped? Some people say yes, but others say you're planning for something you don't know will occur. My mother had to be hospitalized, but because there are rules that apply to Medicare and what hospitals will get paid, I had 48 hours to find a nursing facility that would accept my mother on the income she had. Can I ask guests kind of weigh in on some of that advanced planning, the sort of yes or no and those kind of challenges?
Listen, it's always helpful to have some advanced knowledge about the long-term care system or at least how to get that information. And folks can always call Lifespan or the Alzheimer's Association for that. But it is true, I don't think Tim's experience is unusual, that when you're asked to be discharged from a hospital, families have very little time to make that critical decision, and so some of that planning would be very helpful to know in advance and certainly to know where to call so they can get that information quickly.
And I would also encourage, because almost unanimously when people are in a situation like this, they're in a state of crisis and they feel that they have to react based on what they're being charged to do. We would really encourage families to call Lifespan, ElderSource, or the Alzheimer's Association to have an advocate involved, because then we can help them talk through this, and they still have to make the decision, but they may not have to make the decision so rashly. They'll be able to have what more alternatives might be available to them.
Dr. Thorstenson?
So let me make a few more points. Number one, if we look at this region, so the Finger Lakes area, we have about 26,000 people with dementia right now. We expect that this number may triple over the next 30 years. If you look at just age, then about 13% of people older than 65 have Alzheimer's disease. It's rare in the younger age groups, but I don't blink an eye anymore seeing a person in their early 50s and diagnosing them with a memory disease. If you look at the adult, so 85, it's about half of the population that has some significant memory disease. So this is common. Some of the most disappointing outcomes that I've seen in this area stems from the fact that there wasn't some advanced planning. And therefore, things happened that nobody wanted. Nobody wanted that. The patient wouldn't have wanted it. The family didn't want it. The medical field didn't want it. But your hands were tied. So it's incredibly important to have the discussion. What is your advance directive? Do you have a power of attorney? Do you have some clear ideas or wishes? And this goes for more than Alzheimer's disease. It goes for other medical conditions as well, but particularly for the dementias, because at some point, relatively early in the disease, you lose your capacity to make crisp, good decisions. That's the nature of this disease. Jason pointed it out that this was an insidious onset for his mom. It came on slowly, and it looked like maybe a number of other things. We see this increased anxiety and depression because people feel something's changing and not in a good way. And then there is this slow advancing memory deficit, there's impairment in language abilities and ability to express yourself, and particularly often impairment in your ability to show logic, reasoning, good decision making. And that is one of the reasons why you need kind of caregivers around all the time, very early in the disease. But for dementia, it's particularly important to be clear about who's going to do what if you were to have this disease and you would lose your capacity. So preparation goes a long way.
And here's another part of Tim's email that I confess I don't know anything about what he's describing here, but I do want to air this out because, I suspect he's like a lot of people, dealt with the emotion of it, the frustration of making sure, are you doing the right thing? It's a long email. I mean, he talks about the concern that the more advanced the dementia gets, the more patients you have to feel like you're really confident they're in a good place because they can't always communicate, you know, the impact of care on them, good or bad. But he also says, quote, I have issues with the 5-year look back, which I don't know what that is, but here's what Tim writes. I have issues with the 5-year look back, which is a sham, in my opinion, because if the family went to an estate planner, what the government can get their hands on in the event a skilled nursing home is needed is hidden from sight. Insurance policies, real estate, even cars all get wholesaled at a fraction of their value if you haven't used an attorney to get around it. Is that, Anne-Marie, is that?
Well, you know, he's talking about, obviously, Medicaid and the 5-year look-back period there. And, you know, he is right. I mean, those individuals who do advanced planning and use an elder law attorney, which is legal, you know, have the ability to shelter resources. And, you know, I think what most people don't realize, long-term care is very expensive. And so part of this planning is key to understand advance directives, understand housing options, but also understand the financial and legal aspect of advance planning.
Okay. Here's a very different email. It comes from Jennifer. She says, Evan, there's an amazing documentary about Glenn Campbell, the country music legend living with Alzheimer's, and the movie is about the making of his last album and his tour. He did almost 200 shows in 1 year with his illness. The movie and the album are called Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me. It's on Netflix. He forgets things, but he still knows how to kill it on the guitar. And he says, my dad's mom had dementia, and it was so tough for both my parents. And this movie is so touching and so brave of Mr. Campbell to share with the world. Jennifer just wanted to share that. And Teresa?
That's a really good suggestion. If people are able to watch it, we always encourage people to at least do a little bit of a preview because it can be a little bit painful watching some of these movies, and in particular the Glenn Campbell movie because it's real and it's very raw. But we are grateful to that family for opening the door to their world and allowing us in for that period of time. And he's still living with the disease. He's in a nursing home at this point in time, and his family has been very thoughtful about sharing with the world so that people could understand what it is like to lose those components of yourself that identify you, but at the same time still try to live life as wholly as possible and with great dignity. Another movie that is fictional, Still Alice, came out last year. And that is about a woman in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. She's in her mid-50s when she's diagnosed. And that is actually a really poignant, powerful movie because it is so accurate.
That's Julianne Moore?
Yes, and she won an Oscar for that movie. And it was done superbly. And the Alzheimer's Association actually coached her and her team through that entire process. So that's a pretty realistic movie. So we wouldn't encourage families who are really going through the active mm-hmm. stages right now of caregiving to spend a whole lot of time watching that movie. But if there are families that want to understand better what it is really like to live with Alzheimer's disease, I think Julianne Moore did just a superb job.
All right, I'm late for a break, but Anne-Marie Cook, just remind us once again, part of the point of this hour is to let the community know that there is a need for respite volunteers, that you don't have to have, you know, a career or an educational full body of work of training to become a volunteer, and that that the need is at least 30 families, but it's likely much more than that. And anybody who's hearing this message right now can do what?
Call 325-2800 or hop on the website helpacaregiver.org.
Helpacaregiver.org. Short break. We're going to come back, talk a little bit more about where research is right now, and we'll have a chance with some of our guests to talk about where it might be going next. As we talk about Alzheimer's, caregivers, respite, and help for caregivers as well, with our guests, you just heard Anne-Marie Cook, the president and CEO of Lifespan of Greater Rochester. Teresa Galbiere is the president and CEO of the Alzheimer's Association of Rochester and the Finger Lakes. Dr. Anton Thorstenson is the director of UR Medicine's AdCare, that's Alzheimer's Disease Care Research and Education Program. Jason Doucette's a caregiver, and Sharon Seitz is a respite worker. Much more straight ahead. Coming up in our second hour, paid leave in New York State. What's been proposed? What has passed the Assembly but stalled in the Senate? How would it work? Who would pay for paid time off from work? The employer? The employees? The government? Why do some businesses oppose it? We're going to talk about paid leave and how it could work in New York State next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Seeing several people on Twitter mention that this is a very difficult hour just to listen to. And, you know, you just heard Teresa mention that some of the films that are out there, whether it's Julianne Moore in, it was a fiction. I don't know if that was based on a real life story. It was a fiction.
It was fictional. It was written by a woman named, Dr. Lisa Genova, who's a neurologist. So she had a lot of scientific background to be able to write that movie.
So whether it's, you know, this real story, I'll Be Me, or whether it's technically a fictional story, but with a lot of hallmarks of real life, you know, those can be difficult to watch. We've got people who are listening to the program right now telling us on Twitter, you know, this is difficult. I know it's difficult and emotional because there are so many families going through it. And, you know, that's part of the point. I could spend the entire hour just reading stats on the way Alzheimer's has grown and the way the impact has been. You know, adults over the age of 75 make up the fastest growing segment of our population. People over the age of 85 have a 50% chance of getting Alzheimer's or another memory impairment diagnosis. I mean, we could do this for the entire hour, but let's just talk a little bit about where the research is going. And Dr. Thorstenson, can you kind of give us an update on you know, I don't know if it's sort of a hopeful update or what's going on now, but what the medical community is seeing?
So I have to say I'm an eternal optimist, and that's why I work in this field. But things are turning in a good way. I want to highlight the extra funding that the federal government, in a rare display of unity, agreed upon for Alzheimer's disease, which was the largest single disease increase in the most recent budget, and really was achieved through activity by the Alzheimer's Association and other community organizations, and shows what they are capable of. So this has been kind of a tough couple of decades that I have worked in this field. Alzheimer's disease is not a curable disease. It is a treatable disease, but the treatments that we have currently are pretty modest. So what do we want to do? We want to be able to do much better so that this disease doesn't rob us of another generation. Part of the work that we've done in the past decade or so is to make the process that Jason went through and his family with his mom a little bit simpler. And that is there some hard evidence, what we call biomarkers or imaging, that will help us identify those that are at risk of getting Alzheimer's disease? And simply, we're now able to do that. You don't wake up one day having Alzheimer's disease. We can identify changes in the brain possibly up to 20 years before the disease expresses itself clinically, because the clinical expression of Alzheimer's disease is a late development. It is like if you had cancer, that we waited until someone had basically metastases, that cancer had disseminated all over. So we got to do much better. And that has been a very significant focus of attention, because it sets up the next step. That is, first of all, that we can identify people with the disease with more of a definitive answer, but also that in research we recruit the right people at the right time. What do I mean by that? In some of the past studies with Alzheimer's disease, for medications that treat the pathology, the brain changes, up to a quarter of the patients that we took into the study didn't really have the disease, so it weakened our data. So we are now focused on treatments, the next generation that targets the underpinning of the disease, the brain changes, what we often refer to as the plaques and tangles. We don't want to focus on that only once you have the clinical symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, the forgetfulness and the impairment in logic and reasoning, inability to express yourself, but move to what we call preclinical stages or mild cognitive impairment when you have much milder symptoms, or actually to people that are cognitively normal but have elevated beta amyloid in their brains, as evidenced on specialized brain scans, or the so-called tau tangles are beginning to show themselves as well.
So those are the biomarkers we're talking about?
Yes, those are the biomarkers. Those are the imaging biomarkers and the cerebrospinal fluid biomarkers. And then we're also working on establishing genetic biomarkers as well as blood biomarkers. And some of the blood biomarker work has been very much done here in Rochester by my colleague Mark Mapstone.
And I've talked to Mark about just how careful we have to be in the media. You know, we want to take a small sample size and turn it into a huge headline, or we want to take a first step and declare that blood biomarker or test will predict Alzheimer's. You know, we actually saw those headlines on some pretty reputable news organizations after some of Mark Mapstone's work. And, you know, I think he, rightly so, just tells us to be careful, to be patient. So are we, you know, do we try to jump too quickly, Dr. Thorstensen, and say a test will predict it, or a test will, you know, help us understand really where we are and the process that's going to have to play out here?
Number one, in terms of that, there's a difference between research and clinical practice. You shouldn't take things into clinical practice until you've established a solid evidence base, because you don't know if some of these things will lead you down the wrong path. That's why we have people that participate in research, volunteers, and we've been particularly lucky in Rochester, because this community has been amazing in terms of volunteering in the research that we do. So we have to be very thoughtful about the fact that it will probably take another 5 to 10 years of research to establish what is the real life benefit in clinical practice. It's important basically for two reasons. Number one, will it change outcomes? And none of this is cheap. None of this is inexpensive. And some of it is has an element of risk to it. So it has to be worth it. And we have to establish that. We have to validate these ideas. We have to replicate them. And we have to correlate them into clinical practice. And that takes time. And for that, you know, here's another person in this room asking for volunteers. And that is the same. We need volunteers to participate in research, be that here in Rochester or around the nation, because the only way that we're going to end Alzheimer's disease is by doing it through research. And I think that we are entering kind of at least a silver dawn. I don't know if it is the golden age, but things are getting better And we're seeing support from the state. We're seeing support from the federal government. We certainly have had individual support in this community and the support of organizations. And we're getting traction. There are some interesting and promising early findings that I think we'll leverage over the next decade.
And when it comes to the research, then, you need how many volunteers?
We need volunteers on a consistent basis. So there are probably about 250 people involved in one or another research study at our center. We need people that are 65-year-olds, cognitively normal, but may have a family history or are noticing some subtle changes in their thinking and memory. We need people that have a suspicion that they may have a more significant disease or have been diagnosed with mild Alzheimer's disease. We need people that have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease and are in the mild or early moderate stage. And let alone, we haven't talked about the fact that so many of these people develop behavioral disruptions that can be depression, anxiety, often agitation, irritability, and anger, as well as psychosis. And we're doing studies that focus on the behavioral element of this as well. Most of the research in this community happens at the university, but there are also very good clinics where we have specialized multidisciplinary approach to identify people with memory disease. There's one clinic at Rochester Regional, and there's one clinic at the university, both excellent and staffed by excellent doctors and other professionals. And you need often an expert. You need someone with a lot of training and education to identify the subtle symptoms.
So what can people do then? All right, we've been talking about how they can help volunteer when it comes, well, help, you know, get involved, get training, volunteer, do the kind of respite work, the help for caregivers. But when it comes to the research then, how do you, and Teresa, you want to jump in as well with volunteering?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, yeah, we have a program called Trial Match, and Dr. Thorstenson's actually a member of our MedSci committee, and so he's very involved in that. And Trial Match is a program of the Alzheimer's Association. People would then register to become a member of Trial Match, and what it would do is then help to match them with clinical trials that are going on around the country, most importantly, the ones in our local community as well. So, I mean, they can also contact directly the clinical staff as well, but the Trial Match program helps to get people into the queue of the system.
Okay, and they go where to do that, Trial Match?
They would go to trialmatch.org or contact the Alzheimer's Association. We would actually walk them through the registration process.
Okay, one more research-based question, and I don't want to get hung up on this, but I do think it's an interesting kind of question when it comes to the headlines that said predict Alzheimer's. And it's from the beginning, talking to Mark Mapstone, talking to you, it sounds to me like more of what's going on is not necessarily predicting Alzheimer's, but identifying people who already have it in some form, or, you know, it hasn't manifested yet. And I don't know if that's accurate or not, Dr. Thorstenson, but essentially it makes me wonder, do some of us have it? We live with it, and then it manifests later the older we get. Some of us will never have it, or does it develop in different people for different reasons?
So that's a great question, and I don't know that we have an absolutely 100% answer. So yes, you don't wake up one day having Alzheimer's disease. There are people, and it's a small group, only about 1% of people with Alzheimer's disease, that have an autosomal dominant form of Alzheimer's disease. They get a gene from their parent, and they're destined to get Alzheimer's disease if they live long enough. And the onset for these people are somewhere in their 30s to their 70s, much earlier. You have genetic risk factors, and experts say that though, even with that, that maybe only about a third of patients with Alzheimer's disease, there's an absolute genetic risk factor or group of risk factors or background, or that it's genetically determined. Then we have still two-thirds that we don't know. We don't know what's first blood. What we do know, in order for you to have Alzheimer's disease, there are changes in the brain, and those changes start long before you have any meaningful impairment in your thinking, your memory, your cognition, or your functional abilities. And everyone that has Alzheimer's disease, and of course Alzheimer's disease is just one of the multitudes of dementias, but the most common one, will have beta amyloid plaques and ultimately also develop what are called tau tangles. And we can identify the changes associated with a beta amyloid elevation and this tau. Now, the interesting thing is that a small group, maybe 10 to 15% of people that have advanced Alzheimer's disease pathology in their brain do not have clinical symptoms. They somehow seem to be able to function on what I call brain fumes. There's such a devastation that has happened to their brain tissue. How it is that they can function and appear normal, that actually is an area that also is actively being studied. What is it that makes them able to function so well? And in my home country, Iceland, actually, 0.5% of the population has been identified to have a protective gene. If you have that gene, you basically don't develop the disease. Why is that interesting? Because we need to understand, what does it do so that you don't develop the disease, where by all other measures, you should get the disease. And that can help us with therapeutics and treatment. So let me pitch in one more kind of thing that is more self-serving, and that is, if there is someone who's interested in volunteering in research and you want to contact us directly, again, trial match through the Alzheimer's Association. ClinTrials.gov is also a clearinghouse of available clinical trials. And then reaching out to us directly, our central number in the Alzheimer's Disease Care Research and Education Program is 585-760-6550.
PBR sends an email and says, "My mother had Alzheimer's disease and died in 2013. I echo all the feelings and experiences from your guests, and I want to add one thing to this discussion. After the loved one with Alzheimer's dies, the caregiver doesn't always just bounce back to what used to be normal. With a long view backward, the stress changes shape and takes the form of, I should have done this, why didn't I do that, how could I have reduced her anxiety better? I call this time Alzheimer's caregiver recovery, and at some point I plan to volunteer, but getting very close to it all again is pretty raw. Lifespan and the Alzheimer's Association are fantastic resources." That's I imagine, Anne-Marie, again, that's another sentiment you hear often, that you know, the loved one passes away, and it's not like life is back to exactly what it was before.
You know, just the other day, I actually had two different people that were participating in our center over at the Penfield Y in exact same situation that they had, going through that guilt, trying to figure out their life, because their life had been caregiving, how to do it again. And so they were saying how much exercise, health and wellness, developing new friendships helped them. But it takes time. It takes time, and there are resources available to help people reengage.
I just hope, Jason Doucette, that you don't feel burdened by that guilt of trying to figure out what you could have done differently. I mean, I guess it's natural, but at the same time, you know, I mean, you're already doing, you spent an amazing decade plus as a caregiver, and I hope you're not burdened by that.
I'm not, but that worries me more about, you know, what kind of shape my father might be in, because it's honestly something that hadn't crossed my mind yet.
Well, yeah, Dr.
And about, we should understand that about 50% of caregivers develop significant medical conditions. And by that I mean anxiety disorders, depression. And anxiety, depression, and stress is not good for your health. This is primarily the elderly spouse. And I cannot even begin to count how many caregivers I've seen run themselves into the ground, ignore their own needs and medical conditions, and thus the importance of being able to provide respite, to be able to provide leave so that family members can temporarily step out and help out. It's going to be critical. And we got to figure something out because this is a tsunami that is coming our way. We're struggling today, but time is not our friend here. It's not going to go away. It's going to get worse. And we got to focus on and find better solutions than what we are doing right now.
All right, last word, 15 seconds, Teresa.
And we are trying to take a more holistic approach. So we work with the clinical community, we work with other respite providers, but we also have supportive services. And I think it's important for families to understand that we want them to have all of that education, information, care consultations, and all, because once you have that all wrapped around you, it'll be a much more positive journey.
If you want to volunteer, and they need volunteers to help caregivers and do this sort of respite work, one more time, Anne-Marie Cook.
325-2800 or hop on helpacaregiver.org.
Helpacaregiver.org. They'll help you get started. You don't need an extensive background. You need open hearts and minds on this. And you see from Jason Doucette and his family story the benefits. Good luck to you and your family, Jason. Thanks for sharing your story. I really admire you. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
And thanks to the entire panel for updating us on these efforts to keep working and living with and doing better with Alzheimer's. Short break and much more connections next.